This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News. Thank you to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will bring you news from the Spencer New Leader and the Athol Daily News. The Spencer New Leader is the Friday, July 10th, 2026 edition, and we will read from various editions of the Athol Daily News. I'm Walter Bird with Audio Journal, and we begin with the reading of news from the Spencer New Leader, a publication of Stonebridge Press Newspapers, which is free by request to residents of East Brookfield, West Brookfield, North Brookfield, Brookfield, Leicester, and Spencer. Again, this is the Friday, July 10th, 2026 edition. Our first story is by correspondent Jason Blow. Spencer Rescue Squad completes transition to municipal management. The Spencer Rescue Squad has officially completed its transition into the Spencer Fire and Emergency Services, ending more than 65 years as a nonprofit emergency medical service. As of July 1st, the squad now serves as a municipal division of the Spencer Fire and Emergency Services. The service made the decision to donate all of its assets, including its Bixby Road facility, to the town of Spencer for the price of $1. Squad employees are joining the department along with anticipated new hires at the new Spencer EMS. Spencer Fire and Emergency Services posted on social media a little after midnight July 1st, confirming the ceremonial turning over of the keys. Quote, tonight, after serving the community of Spencer, since 1959, Spencer Rescue and Emergency Squad closed their doors and their last run completed just before the turnover. At midnight, President Vincent Cloutier turned over the keys to the building to Town Administrator Jeff Bridges. At 12:01, Spencer EMS is serving the community as a division under the fire department. Without the board of directors' forethought and generous donation of all the assets to the town, this would not be possible, end quote. The post read, the Spencer Rescue Squad had previously posted a message to the public on its page on the town website acknowledging the impending change. Quote, for the past 68 years, the Spencer Rescue Squad has been honored to serve this community. We sincerely thank our employees, volunteers, board members, and residents for their steady support, generosity, and trust over the years. We hope you'll continue to support your town EMS services in the years ahead, end quote, the message read. The Spencer Rescue Squad had previously worked as a subscription-based agency but announced its impending closure in 2025, offering to join the town as a municipal department. While town officials also considered privatizing the EMS service, they eventually adopted the squad into its ranks in January 2026. In May, a town meeting approved an initial operating budget of $1.5 million for Spencer EMS with a legal agreement for the changeover signed in June. According to the Telegram and Gazette, the agreement was approved by the State Supreme Judicial Court on June 26, just in time for the official changeover. Next up this week, Spencer East Brookfield Superintendent will not seek new contract. Spencer East Brookfield Regional School District Superintendent Paul Howey announced he will not seek a successor contract at the conclusion of his current term, which ends June 30, 2027. The early announcement gives the school committee a full year to plan and conduct a comprehensive search for the district's next educational leader, ensuring a stable and structured transition. Howey said, quote, serving the towns of Spencer and East Brookfield has been the highlight of my career. I am making this announcement now to give our school committee ample time to find the right leader for our next chapter. Over the next year, my absolute priority remains guiding our schools, supporting our educators, and ensuring our students have everything they need to thrive, end quote. During his remaining tenure, Superintendent Howey will continue to oversee all district operations, academic programming, and strategic goals while collaborating with school leadership to prepare for the transition. And registration open for Brookfield's Lions Club Golf Tournament. In North Brookfield, registration is now open for the 2026 Brookfield's Lions Club Golf Tournament, according to event chair Mark Kukansky. The annual event takes place Saturday, August 22nd at the Quail Hollow Country Club, 1822 Old Turnpike Road in Ocare. A four-person scramble tournament begins with registration at noon, followed by a 1 p.m. shotgun start. The entry fee is $100 per golfer, which includes 18 holes of golf, cart, skins competition, closest to the pin contest, and a meal following the tournament at Quail Hollow Country Club. Proceeds from the tournament will benefit the Brookfield Lions Club's charitable programs and community service projects throughout the area. Through fundraising events such as this tournament, the club supports local organizations and individuals while carrying out the Lions' mission of serving those in need. To register a team or obtain additional information, contact Mark Kukansky at 508-847-9843. Registration is open now through August 15th. As the world's largest, youngest, and most active service organization, the mission of the Lions Clubs International is to empower volunteers to serve their communities, meet humanitarian needs, encourage peace, and promote international understanding. Members of the Brookfield Lions Club are dedicated to service and support in the communities of Brookfield, East Brookfield, North Brookfield, West Brookfield, and New Braintree. Well, next up, correspondent Jason Blue has this story. Amateur Radio Club participates in annual field day in West Brookfield. Blue writes, "While technology has certainly come a long way since the days of analog radio, the art of this form of traditional radio communication remains alive through clubs across the country, including locally with the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club. On June 27th, members of the club came together for the biggest annual ham and amateur radio on-air event in the country, the American Radio Relay League, or ARRL, Field Day. But this wasn't the radio many use every day that they tune into in their cars. This involved radio operators literally going into the field to simulate an emergency radio scenario and communicating with each other from states and even countries away. Operators set up camp on the West Brookfield Common, including generators, antennas, and radio stations, and spent the full day and night communicating with fellow operators from other clubs, not only brushing up on their skills, but also simulating how they would work to maintain communication if an emergency were to strike. Howard Sir, a member of the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club, explained that while many might believe radio communication is unnecessary thanks to modern technology like cell phones, it's the only type of long-range communication that could survive a major weather or emergency event that impacts power systems and cell towers, making it essential for national safety and security. Sir said, quote, "Without emergency communications, lives can be lost, property can be lost, there's a lot of danger out there. You can't get first responders to respond unless they find out where there's needed, and that's where we step in," end quote. Club President Ken Miller echoed this reality, noting how all the radios at the field day were not powered by traditional sources of electricity, but rather portable ones. He also stressed the importance of this annual day of practice to prove to officials in Washington, D.C. that their radio bands should remain reserved for any emergency. Miller said, quote, "The practice is getting here, setting up antennas and doing all this out in the field. It's not in your house or garage. It's using trees or whatever is available to you to deploy antennas and use batteries and generators. We have redundancies. If we're not active and we're not using the spectrum we have allotted to us, there's a good chance they look at that and they redesignate it for some other service. So it's important to keep the bands active, and things like this help to make that possible," end quote. Overall, the field day proved to be another big success, as well as an opportunity to educate those who wanted to learn more about radio communication and possibly take up the hobby themselves. Those who want to learn more about the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club can visit QVARC or QVARC.com. And there is a photo accompanying this story, and it shows members of the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club manning their post for the annual field day on June 27th. Lions Club seeks to launch new Warren Club through Community Service Carnival. Out of Warren, the public is invited to experience the service, fellowship, and community spirit of Lions Clubs at the upcoming Lions Service Carnival on Saturday, July 18th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at St. Stanislaus Polish Club, 2270 Main Street, West Warren, in conjunction with the Ware Lions. This family-friendly event will showcase the many ways Lions Club serve their communities while offering a day of fun, activities, food, and entertainment for all ages. Visitors will have the opportunity to learn about Lions Club membership and community service programs, as well as participate in free eye screenings. Children can enjoy a bounce house and games, while complimentary refreshments, including snow cones, cotton candy, popcorn, hot dogs, and water, will be available for children while supplies last. A highlight of the day will be a cornhole tournament beginning at noon. Registration and warm-up activities start at 11 a.m. The entry fee is $20 per person, with cash prizes awarded to top competitors. Participants may register in advance through the Scoreholio app or sign up on the day of the tournament. All proceeds from the tournament will benefit local veterans. Kurt Jameson, past district governor of Lions Club's District 33A and chair of the event, said, quote, This event is a way we can make the community aware of what the Lions have to offer the community, and it is also part of a membership drive with the hopes of starting a new club in Warren, end quote. Well, the event is open to the public, and admission is free. For more information, contact Jameson at curt6203@gmail.com. That's C-U-R-T. The number is 6203@gmail.com. Derek Mahoney of Leicester, named to University of Rhode Island's Dean's List. This is what's next. Kingston, Rhode Island, the University of Rhode Island is pleased to announce Derek Mahoney of Leicester has been named to its Spring 2026 Dean's List. To be included on the list, full-time students must have completed 12 or more credits for letter grades which are GPA applicable during a semester and achieved at least a 3.30 through 3.79 GPA. Part-time students qualify with the accumulation of 12 or more credits for letter grades which are GPA applicable, earning at least a 3.30 through 3.79 grade point average. Students named to the Dean's List represent nearly all of Rhode Island's cities and towns, all six New England states, New York, and New Jersey, along with many other states and countries. And Abigail Radabaugh, named to President's List at Plymouth State University. In Plymouth, New Hampshire, Abigail Radabaugh of Brookfield has been named to the Plymouth State University President's List for the Spring 2026 semester. To be named to the President's List, a student must achieve a grade point average of 3.70 or better for the Spring 2026 semester, and must have completed at least 12 credit hours during a semester, at least 9 of which must confer grade points at the time the lists are finalized. Radabaugh is majoring in nursing at Plymouth State. And out of Kingston, Rhode Island, Patrick Scholl of Spencer, named to University of Rhode Island President's List. The University of Rhode Island is pleased to announce Patrick Scholl of Spencer has been named to its Spring 2026 President's List. To be included on this President's List, full-time students must have completed 12 or more credits for letter grades, which are GPA applicable during a semester, and achieve the list at least a 3.80 through 4.0 grade point average. East Brookfield Library offers summer activities, crafts for children and families. This is what's next in the Spencer New Leader this week. The East Brookfield Public Library invites children and families to take part in a variety of summer activities designed to encourage creativity, learning, and fun. The library's weekly activity and play program will be held Tuesdays at 10:30 a.m. as an extension of the library's storytime program. Caregivers are required to remain with participating children, with one adult required for every two children. A series of special afternoon activities begins at 2 p.m. throughout the summer. The schedule includes paper airplane making, which took place June 30th, cornhole, which took place on July 7th, sidewalk chalk drawing, which happens July 14th, bubbles on July 21st, origami on July 28th, bracelet making on August 4th, and a guided tour of the library pond on August 11th. The library will also host a summer arts and crafts program beginning June 23rd. And additional sessions were scheduled for July 21st, August 4th, and August 18th, with all programs starting at 11 a.m. Registration is required for the Arts and Crafts program. Adult caregivers must attend with children under age 12, with one adult required for every two children. Some projects may continue into the following week's session. Library officials encourage families to register early and participate in the wide range of educational and recreational activities planned throughout the summer. For more information or to register, contact the East Brookfield Public Library. Next up, Leicester Democratic Town Committee plans second annual potluck barbecue. The Leicester Democratic Town Committee is inviting Democrats from across Central Mass to gather for an afternoon of food, conversation, and community at a second annual potluck BBQ. The event is designed to bring together local residents and party members to reconnect with friends, meet new people, exchange ideas, and strengthen relationships ahead of the upcoming election season. Organizers encourage attendees to bring a favorite dish to share while enjoying an informal afternoon focused on fellowship and civic engagement. Organizers in the event announcement said, quote, "Come together with Democratic friends from across Central Mass for an afternoon of great food, laughter, and meaningful conversation. It's a chance to reconnect with old friends, make new ones, share ideas, and strengthen the relationships that will help us work together during the upcoming election season," end quote. Participants are asked to bring a potluck item and are encouraged to RSVP by Sunday, August 16th. Registration is required. The event location will only be provided to those who register in advance. Organizers said they hope attendees will leave with new connections, fresh ideas, and renewed enthusiasm for the months ahead. For more information or to register, visit the Leicester Democratic Town Committee's website at ldtc-mass.org. Or actually, I believe that's ldtcmass.org, no hyphen. The Sons of the American Legion, the host 21st Annual Scholarship Scramble. This is out of West Brookfield. The Sons of the American Legion Post 244 will host its 21st Annual Scholarship Scramble Golf Tournament Saturday, August 8th, raising funds to support local scholarships. The tournament will be played at Quail Hollow Country Club in Ocam with an 8 a.m. shotgun start. Golfers will compete over 18 holes before returning to American Legion Post 244 in West Brookfield for a chicken dinner, raffles, and prize presentations. The entry fee is $120 per person, and registrations must be received by August 1st. The annual event serves as a fundraiser for the Sons of the American Legion's scholarship program, which supports local students pursuing higher education. Organizers encourage golfers of all skill levels to participate while helping invest in educational opportunities for area students. For more information or to register, contact Kevin at 774-230-3262 or Gary at 508-450-8643. Out of Haverhill, Monique Carrasco of Spencer earns Dean's List honor. Congratulations to Monique Carrasco of Spencer on earning a spot on the Dean's List for the spring 26 semester. Her hard work is paying off, and all of those at NECC are proud of her achievement. And to be included, students must attain a grade point average of 3.3 or higher within the term, carry six or more credits within the term, and be matriculated in a degree program. Up next, Spencer Town moderator launches new community television show called The Brewster Call. In Spencer, Jason Brewster, the newly elected town moderator of Spencer, is announcing the launch of The Brewster Call, a new community television show on Spencer Cable Access Channel 192. The show airs Fridays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. and focuses on informed civic participation and respectful dialogue. Special thanks to Spencer Cable Access for making this program possible and for its continued commitment to local programming and community engagement. The Brewster Call is produced by Jason Brewster in his capacity as a private citizen. The views expressed are his own and should not be construed as official statements or positions of the Spencer Town Moderator or the Town of Spencer. For questions or episode suggestions, email thebrewstercall@gmail.com. And we have the weekly police blotter in this issue. The Spencer Police Department had no arrest to report during the week of June 24th to the 30th. Here is the activity from Leicester. An individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on June 25th for aggravated organized retail crime totaling more than $10,000, possession of a Class A drug with intent to distribute, and distribution of a Class B drug. An individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on June 29th for operating a motor vehicle after suspension of registration. And an individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on June 30th for trespassing, operating a motor vehicle after suspension of license, failure to stop for police, reckless operation of a motor vehicle, and driving at a rate of speed greater than was reasonable and proper. This week's editorial is titled, A New Chapter Built on a Strong Foundation. And this, of course, comes from the Spencer New Leader. Communities rarely get the opportunity to witness the end of one era and the beginning of another in a way that honors both the past and the future. Spencer experienced exactly that on July 1st, when the Spencer Rescue Squad officially became part of Spencer Fire and Emergency Services. For nearly seven decades, the Spencer Rescue Squad represented something larger than an ambulance service. It embodied the spirit of neighbors helping neighbors. Since 1959, generations of volunteers, board members, EMTs, and paramedics answered calls at all hours, often sacrificing holidays, family time, and sleep to ensure someone in need received care. Thousands of residents owe those men and women a debt of gratitude. The transition to a municipal EMS service should not be viewed as the end of that legacy. Instead, it is a continuation of it. The reality facing emergency medical services today is far different from what it was decades ago. Call volumes have increased, regulations have become more complex, equipment has grown more sophisticated, and the cost of providing high-quality emergency care continues to rise. Across Massachusetts and the nation, volunteer and nonprofit rescue organizations have struggled to recruit personnel and maintain sustainable funding. Spencer is hardly alone in confronting these challenges. What makes this story remarkable is not simply that a transition occurred, but how it occurred. Rather than allowing uncertainty to threaten emergency medical care, the leadership of the Spencer Rescue Squad chose collaboration over conflict. Donating the organization's building, equipment, and other assets to the town for $1 was an extraordinary act of stewardship. It demonstrated the board's highest priority was never ownership of an organization. It was ensuring residents would continue to receive dependable emergency medical care. That decision deserves recognition. The town, for its part, also deserves credit for recognizing the importance of maintaining local EMS. Municipal officials considered several options, including privatization, before ultimately determining a town-operated service would provide the best path forward. That decision required significant financial commitment, including the approval of a $1.5 million operating budget, but it also represents an investment in public safety that will benefit residents for years to come. Perhaps the most encouraging aspect of the transition is that many of the familiar faces will remain. Experienced Spencer Rescue Squad employees are joining the new municipal department, bringing decades of institutional knowledge with them. While the name on the ambulance may have changed, much of the dedication and professionalism behind it has not. Communities often become attached to the organizations that have faithfully served them. That attachment is understandable, particularly when an organization has existed for nearly 70 years. There is always a sense of nostalgia when a respected institution closes its doors. Yet, history shows successful organizations evolve when circumstances demand it. The measure of success is not whether a name survives forever, but whether the mission continues. In Spencer, the mission has always been simple: respond quickly, provide skilled emergency medical care, and help people during some of their worst moments of their lives. That mission remains unchanged. As Spencer EMS begins this new chapter, residents can honor the Rescue Squad's remarkable legacy by supporting the men and women who continue that work today. The uniforms may look different and the organizational chart may have changed, but the commitment to serving the community remains the same. The Spencer Rescue Squad story did not end on July 1st. It simply turned the page to a new chapter built upon nearly 7 decades of service, sacrifice, and community trust. That is a legacy worth celebrating. Next up, it's financial focus. Trevor Nielsen is the columnist, and the title is The Hidden Danger of Investing Too Cautiously. One of the most significant risks investors face isn't losing money in a market dip. It's failing to reach their long-term financial goals. Many people focus heavily on short-term losses in the stock market and try to protect their savings by investing conservatively or avoiding stocks altogether. But that runs the risk that their savings won't grow enough to keep up with inflation or support future needs. Understanding what investment risk really means helps you make smarter financial decisions, considering these three key aspects. Risk tolerance describes your emotional comfort with risk. If you want to pull your money out of the market during a downturn, that reveals something about your tolerance. Many financial advisors use questionnaires to help clients understand how they might react in different market conditions. Risk capacity refers to how much risk you can afford to take. Your timeline matters. A 35-year-old saving for retirement has decades to ride out market swings. A retiree drawing income from their portfolio does not have that same cushion. Required risk describes how much risk you may need to take to reach your financial goals. Higher returns generally come with higher risk, though higher risk does not guarantee higher returns. If you need strong growth to retire comfortably, you may need to accept more short-term volatility. Sometimes these elements don't line up. You might be uncomfortable with risk, but need strong growth to meet your goals. Balance and diversification matter. Finding the right balance matters more than you might think. A small difference in your annual rate of return from 5 to 7%, for instance, doesn't just add up to a little. It multiplies. That's the power of compounding. Returns earning their own returns year after year, building on an ever-growing base. Over 30 or 35 years, that can become significant. You needn't choose between playing it so safe your money barely keeps up with inflation and taking on more risk than you're comfortable with. Instead, a balanced mix can fit your comfort level and still help grow your money over time. The age factor. You'll want to adjust your approach to risk as you get older. If retirement is years away, your portfolio may lean toward growth investments like stocks and stock mutual funds. You have time to absorb short-term losses and benefit from long-term gains. Lower-risk investments like bonds still play a role because they can help smooth out changes in your portfolio's value. As you near retirement, your portfolio may shift toward a more even mix of stocks and bonds to limit exposure to larger market swings. The goal is to protect what you've built while still generating enough growth to fund a retirement that could last decades. Investing well isn't about eliminating risk. It's about taking the right amount of it. Too little risk can be just as damaging as too much. A financial advisor can help you find the balance that matches your comfort level, your financial situation, and your long-term goals. Investors should understand the risks involved with owning investments, including interest rate risk, credit risk, and market risk. The value of investments fluctuates, and investors can lose some or all of their principal. We have obituaries this week in the Spencer New Leader. Out of West Warren, Robert B. Masterman, 83, passed away peacefully Wednesday, July 1st, 2026. He is survived by his brother and caretaker, William H. Masterman, Jr. of Westbrookfield. He was predeceased by his brother, David H. Masterman. Robert was born in Ware and raised in Warren, the son of the late William H. and Hazel Williams Masterman, Sr. He enjoyed working on cars. He was a longtime member of George Whitefield United Methodist Church in West Brookfield, loved playing bingo, and taking art classes. All were invited to his funeral service, which was held Friday, July 10th at Varnum Funeral Home. It was followed by burial in Pine Grove Cemetery in Warren. Memorial donations in Robert's memory may be made to Mental Health Collaborative, 149 Wood Street, Hopkinton, Mass., 01748. Artworks Gallery invites art lovers to landscape. This is out of Ware. Workshop 13's Artworks Gallery in Ware presents a new exhibition called Landscape. This exhibition aims to expand or even reimagine the traditional landscape as a personal sanctuary and to document the diverse spatial forms of escapism that we need to recharge our spirits. Artworks Gallery is located at 69 Main Street in Ware. Landscape is on display through August 2nd. Gallery hours are Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 4 p.m. And for those who cannot attend this show in person, a virtual gallery is available for viewing at workshop13.org. Next up this week, Historical Society and Library present A Night at Jenks Tavern. In Spencer, the Spencer Historical Commission and the Richard Sugden Library present A Night at Jenks Tavern. Spencer celebrates the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. On Thursday, July 16th, from 6 to 9 p.m., it will be held at the Richard Sugden Library. The library reading room will be transformed into Jenks Tavern, the historic Spencer Tavern, where George Washington slept overnight and the next morning complimented Mrs. Jenks on her quote-unquote beautiful bread. The evening will begin with judging for Mrs. Jenks' bread-baking contest and will include refreshments, music, tavern games, and children's activities. Period costumes are optional but encouraged. Baking contest rules will be posted and available on the library website. All are welcome to join in a revolutionary celebration. Here's a look at this week's Friday's Child. Angel is a bright, independent young man with a kind and compassionate heart. He is 14 years old. He's funny, witty, and enjoys connecting with others through his great sense of humor. An exceptionally talented athlete, Angel loves sports and especially enjoys playing baseball and football, although he modestly describes his ability as just all right. His confidence and skill are evident every time he steps onto the field. His dedication, teamwork, and natural athleticism make sports an important part of his life. When he's not playing sports, Angel enjoys spending time playing video games and watching movies. Looking ahead, he dreams of becoming an athlete, though he remains open-minded and excited to explore other possibilities for his future. Angel is a thoughtful, determined young man with a bright future ahead of him. He is eager to continue pursuing his interests, exploring new opportunities, and building meaningful connections with those around him. You can learn more at www.mareinc.org/child/211814213 Again, that's www.mareinc.org/child/211814213 Now, can you adopt? If you are at least 18 years old, have a stable source of income, and room in your heart, you may be a perfect match to adopt a waiting child. Adoptive parents can be single, married, or partnered, experienced or not, renters or homeowners, LGBTQ plus singles and couples. As an adoptive parent, you won't have to pay any fees. Adoption from foster care is completely free in Massachusetts. The process to adopt a child from foster care includes training, interviews, and home visits to determine if adoption is right for you. These steps will help match you with a child or a sibling group that your family will fit well with. To learn more about adoption from foster care, again, you can visit www.mareinc.org. Massachusetts Adoption Resource Exchange, or MARE, can give you guidance and information on the adoption process. Reach out today to find out all the ways you can help children and teens in foster care. Very quickly, we look at the upcoming weather forecasts. Monday, the 13th, partly cloudy, a high of 83 and a low of 65. We reach up into the 90s on Tuesday the 14th with partly cloudy skies, a high of 93, a low of 76. Back into the 80s for Wednesday the 15th, a high of 89 and a low of 66. Thursday, a high of 87, a low of 63 with partly cloudy skies. And Friday is mostly sunny with a high of 82 and a low of 61 degrees. We're time now to read news from the Athol Daily News. Our first story from the Athol News today, reflecting on the fight for freedom. Declaration of Independence readings hell. This is by Dominic Poli and Madison Schofield, the July 12, 2026 edition. State Senator Paul Mark and State Rep. Susanna Whips joined in the Massachusetts Commission on the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution's effort to place a commemorative copy of the Declaration of Independence in every city and town ahead of the 250th anniversary of the document's first public reading on July 8, 1776. The deliveries continued through Wednesday with legislators across the state working to ensure every municipality could receive a copy. Several Franklin County communities, including Greenfield and Orange, took the opportunity to hold public readings. Mark, the Commission's Senate co-chair, said in a statement, quote, "One of the Commission's goals is to ensure every Massachusetts community has the opportunity to participate in these commemorations. I'm grateful to work alongside Representative Whips to help bring this initiative to communities across Franklin County." In a statement, Whips, an independent from Athol, said, quote, "I was happy to deliver these historic documents to clerks and historical societies throughout the 2nd Franklin District. For my towns, I was accompanied by Revolutionary War reenactor Jeffrey Cook of Royalston, whose participation helped bring this important chapter of our nation's history to life. These presentations are a meaningful way to honor the people and places that have preserved our local history for generations," end quote. Whips presented the Orange Select Board with the town's parchment reproduction at its July 1st meeting and also delivered a copy to Greenfield City Hall on Monday. Greenfield Mayor Ginny DeSorger said, quote, "It was printed using 18th century techniques at the Museum of Printing in Haverhill," end quote. With reproductions of the Declaration of Independence, DeSorger said the state hoped municipalities would hold readings similar to those held across the colonies in 1776 when the document was first signed. DeSorger said, quote, "When the Declaration of Independence arrived in Massachusetts, our early revolutionary government ordered it to be reproduced. Copies were read at churches and then delivered to town clerks," end quote. Orange held a celebration on Wednesday to commemorate the country's 250th birthday. Before the Orange Community Band played an array of patriotic music, Julie Capone Bouchard sang the national anthem, and Orange Community Band trumpeter Adam Witten led attendees in a musical rendition of the Pledge of Allegiance. Ann Reed, an Orange Historical Society member and descendant of multiple Revolutionary War patriots, read the Declaration of Independence and delivered remarks about Orange's connection with independence, gleaned from various records and reports. Quote, "When word of the signing of the Declaration of Independence reached the settlement of Orange in the summer of 1776, dancing in the streets ensued. Printed copies of the freshly inked document were being distributed throughout the colonies via post riders. Dispatched from Philadelphia, news of the Declaration's signing had taken nearly 2 weeks to reach Boston, and so a bit longer to reach Orange," end quote, she read from a podium on the handstand. Reed added, quote, "Church bells pealed in the distance. The Provincial Congress of Massachusetts had compelled local ministers throughout the land to read the text aloud from their pulpits, after which the copies were committed to municipal files," end quote. Reed explained that royal symbols were permanently yanked off of their fixtures and patriots hit the taverns to celebrate. Christopher Woodcock, former longtime town moderator, then took the podium. He read, quote, "As much of those founding fathers are respected and revered, we should never lose sight of an important fact regarding the American Revolution. It was regular everyday people who stood up to fight for freedom and independence. It was everyday people who risked their lives in the quest to break free from the tyranny of British rule and establish a new democratic republic. Before the armed conflict began, these folks had been living humble, ordinary lives as farmers, laborers, tradesmen, even teenagers," end quote, he continued. Woodcock said Massachusetts served as the epicenter of the rebellion and contributed more soldiers to the Continental Army than any other colony. The story of Revolutionary War service by local people is chronicled in a history of Orange that was written by Beatrice Minor, a longtime teacher, and published in 1976 by the Orange Historical Society. According to that town history, Woodcock said, 27 men from the Orange area served in the military during the American Revolution. 15 of the local soldiers are buried in the North Orange Cemetery. Before reading the preamble to the Declaration of Independence in Greenfield on Wednesday, de Soto took to the podium in front of City Hall, recounting how, quote, the colonists were fed up with British rules, taxes, and overreach, end quote. And she said, quote, out of that frustration came some of the most powerful words ever put on paper, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by the Creator certain unalienable rights, that among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, end quote. The mayor said that reading the Declaration of Independence provides an opportunity to reflect on how far the nation has come in the 250 years since it first declared its independence, as well as how far it still has to go. Said De Soto, quote, we are here to celebrate those rights and also must recognize they haven't always been extended to everyone equally. So we have to hold two truths at the same time. It is true that America's history involves injustice, and it is true that America's history is a promise of freedom and equality. Our history is full of brave people working to make that promise real. A decade after the Declaration, the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, and they started with the words, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. A more perfect union. Those words recognize that America is a work in progress. It is an unfinished project. It is up to us to keep working on it, end quote, the slogan said. Next up, this story by Sam Furlan from July 12th. Massachusetts lawmakers push for strict data center rules. State lawmakers have proposed a legislative change that would hold data centers responsible for their environmental and financial impacts on communities as developers continue to eye Massachusetts as an ideal location. The proposed amendment, part of the state Senate's affordability package, Senate Bill 3143, which passed in a 32-8 vote last week, comes as state and federal lawmakers grapple with mounting data center proposals. Said State Senator John Vilas, a Democrat of Westfield, quote, it is difficult to go out in one of the communities I represent right now and someone doesn't bring up the conversation of data centers, end quote. The data center debate landed in Vilas' district last month when the Holyoke City Council banned any artificial intelligence data center development over 12 megawatts after a 20-megawatt data center along the Connecticut River at 100 Water Street was proposed. Many residents of the Paper City and neighbors rallied against the data center proposal, with concerns ranging from water pollution and strains on Holyoke's electrical supply to potential noise pollution and fears that such centers could be used as part of a fascist tactic to harvest personal data. Other communities are adopting or working on moratoriums for data centers. The Westfield City Council approved a one-year ban at its meeting Monday night, and Greenfield is in the process of drafting a similar measure. Shutesbury, meanwhile, currently has a data center prohibition, a measure that was put in place last September. Vilas said it is the job of elected officials to respond to their constituents' needs, and he feels the legislative amendment would do that by establishing set-in-stone restrictions to ensure data centers' costs would not fall on residents, while also establishing environmental protections. Vilas said, quote, we're moving in the direction where essentially everything is powered by data, end quote. He emphasized lawmakers must ensure Massachusetts data centers, quote, will have to follow parameters, end quote. The bill still has several hurdles to jump, however. It must be considered by the State House of Representatives before being sent to Governor Maura Healey's desk. Energy policy negotiations have been among the trickiest for lawmakers to settle in recent sessions. In addition to imposing clean energy requirements on data centers, the bill as a whole charts a path to wind down a program that helps cover the cost of replacing leak-prone gas pipes, with strict mass-save spending on planning and administrative expenses, and more. The Senate approved the bill just a week after Healey announced an energy framework on June 25th, establishing that the state will not accept applications for data center tax incentives. Until further notice, freezing the state's 2024 sales and use tax exemption for data center projects. Healey has said that data centers can, quote, support innovation and economic growth, but if developers want to build in Massachusetts, they need to first demonstrate that they can do so without driving up costs or harming our communities, end quote. The framework says data center projects, quote, are expected to bring their own clean energy, avoid shifting or increasing costs to other energy consumers, protect environmental and community health, avoid placing additional environmental and social burdens on already burdened areas, and contribute meaningfully to the local and state economy and clean energy goals, end quote. One of the amendments in the Senate bill regarding data centers attributed to Senator Vanna Howell, a Democrat of Lowell, would specifically require newer expanded centers to use their own sources of clean energy, phase out fossil fuel backups, pay their own gas infrastructure costs, meet water protection and cumulative impact standards, sign project labor and community benefit agreements, report energy and water usage publicly, and forfeit the state tax exemption if not in compliance. Quote, the amendment that did pass was a codification of what the governor passed a week before, end quote, Vilas said. He noted that when projects are proposed, data set to developers often claim there will be no disruption to local water and energy consumption. However, he said, quote, that is not the case. Quote, water costs go up, energy costs go up, and the communities are on the hook for it. And I just view that as fundamentally unfair, and that cannot be allowed to happen, end quote, Vilas said. The senator originally proposed his own amendment to the bill, which was ultimately rejected, and would have held data centers operating at or above 20 megawatts accountable for the full cost of all electricity and water consumption, removing any financial burden from residents. It also would have mandated electric distribution companies to separately track and report all data center-related expenses. While his specific proposal did not pass, Vilas said he is pleased many of its core values and regulations were incorporated into the amendment that succeeded. Even though the broader bill has not officially passed yet, he said lawmakers will have to continuously revisit data center regulations as the technology grows. Vilas added that while data centers are often associated with AI, data collection impacts all forms of everyday life. Said Vilas, quote, technology moves a lot faster than government. I wish government could get out of its own way and be more nimble, more adaptive, and flexible, end quote. But next up, Markey and Moulton trade jabs in Western Mass primary debate. This is the July 10th story by Tim Dunn. Dunn writes out of Chicopee, U.S. Senator Ed Markey and Congressman Seth Moulton faced off Wednesday in a Western Massachusetts primary debate hitting on everything from Markey's age to Moulton's stance on trans athletes and issues focused on the region. The debate aired on WWLP featuring five local journalists who alternated in asking the two candidates questions. Both Moulton and Markey were given 30 seconds to respond to each question as well as a 30-second rebuttal. When Markey and Moulton weren't clashing with each other, both Democratic candidates quickly pivoted to criticizing President Donald Trump, congressional Republicans, and the MAGA movement, while highlighting their efforts to fight against them. The first question was on Markey's age, as he runs for another six-year term. Markey, who turns 80 on Saturday, said he still feels young and spry. He added that the focus should be on defeating the worst of Washington, placing both Trump and Moulton in that category. Quote, we need to be looking ahead to the issues that every single family wants to have fought for. And that's what I do every single day on the floor of the United States Senate, end quote, Markey said, after attacking Moulton on alleged insider trading, saying the six-term congressman has made deals with defense contractors who have appeared before the House Armed Services Committee, on which Moulton serves. Markey said, quote, what Congressman Moulton has done is he has taken advantage of sweetheart deal opportunities which private equity companies have given to him to invest in companies like Aura and Divergent that appear before his Armed Services Committees. And he's been allowed to invest in those funds, and he has now reaped millions of dollars of opportunities from those investments, end quote. Moulton, 47, took a cautious approach to criticizing Markey's age, instead expressing respect for Markey's half-century of service in Washington before arguing the current establishment just isn't working and that we need new ideas and a new playbook. The candidates were also asked about comments Moulton made in November 2024 regarding transgender athletes competing in girls and women's sports. Moulton had said he doesn't want his daughters, quote, getting run over on the playing field by male or formerly male athletes, end quote. He was criticized nationally by Democrats, including the Mass Democratic Party, for the comments. He initially defended his position before later walking the comments back. Moulton said, when pressed on his current stance, quote, let me be clear to anyone out there listening tonight. Anyone in the LGBTQ community or anyone else, I stand with you because I've always stood with you. And I have seen the pain you are going through because of this hateful Trump administration. This is a crisis, and I'm very proud of the fact that I have a 100% voting record from the Human Rights Campaign. I have your back because I've always had your back, and I will have your back in the future, end quote. Markey said Moulton threw trans kids under the bus after Democrats lost in 2024. Markey said, quote, there's a clear difference between my record and Congressman Moulton's. After the 2024 election, Congressman Moulton decided he was going to throw trans kids under the bus, the political bus, and blame them for the loss of the election. Those kids are vulnerable. Those kids need love. Those kids don't need to be scapegoated and blamed for what was wrong with the Democratic Party, end quote. The debate also touched on other national issues, including the termination of temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants, the rise of the Democratic Socialists of America within the Democratic Party, and foreign policy. The conversation also turned to regional issues, including funding for Western Massachusetts hospitals, east-west passenger rail connecting the region to Boston, and each lawmaker's record of securing federal funding for Western Mass. Markey said, quote, with Congressman Ruccinio, we were able to secure $157 million for West-East Rail because it is absolutely essential that we connect the Western Mass economy to the rest of the economy of Massachusetts. It's been long overdue, end quote. Rocky mentioned a number of projects he's worked on in Western Mass, including the asthma crisis in Springfield and securing funding to clean up the Housatonic River. He said, quote, I worked on every one of those projects to make sure the funding would be there for every one of the issues out here in Western Mass, end quote. Walton responded by saying the $157 million Markey referenced will not be enough to complete the track. Walton said, quote, with all due respect, no one's going to ride your train because it's too slow. You had 50 years in Washington to get this done, and it's not done. And meanwhile, the rest of the world is passing us by, end quote. Moulton said he authored the American High-Speed Rail Act, which was introduced in May, and claimed that could bring a high-speed rail service that travels from Springfield to Boston in 40 minutes. Quote, imagine what that would do for job opportunities. Imagine what that would do to knit our state together, end quote, he said. Representation in each lawmaker's communities was debated. Moulton said Western Mass communities have been, quote, left behind by the politicians in Washington and in Boston, end quote, which he has heard during his 50 town halls held across the state. He said he shows up for his community, unlike Markey. Markey argued he does show up for this part of the state, which is part of the reason he has been endorsed by mayors from Springfield, Northampton, East Hampton, and Pittsfield. Markey said, quote, they know that when they have a call to make and they want something done, that if they call me, I will get it done. That is a big difference between the two of us, end quote. The hour-long event marked the first head-to-head matchup between Markey and Moulton in the state's key political race this year. Two more debates on August 3rd and August 20th are on the docket before the September 1st primary. Healey signed $63.4 billion budget with no vetoes. This is by Allison Kuznets from July 10th. Kuznets writes out of Boston, Governor Maura Healey signed the $63.4 billion annual budget Thursday, coming 9 days into the new fiscal year that's poised to inflict major financial turmoil as a federal law reshapes public benefit programs. The signed fiscal year 2027 budget was delivered to Secretary of State Bill Galvin's office just before 2 p.m., a spokesperson told the news service. With election season heating up, the governor did not make any vetoes to the package, according to a Healey spokesperson. Lawmakers shipped it to the governor's desk last Wednesday ahead of a long holiday weekend that featured the state's signature Mass 250 celebration. Healey had until July 11th to take action and had signed an interim budget June 30th. Administration and Finance Secretary Matthew Gorskovich said in a statement, our fiscal 2027 budget protects the long-term stability of Massachusetts' finances while making targeted investments in the sectors that drive our economy and make our state the best place in the country to live. By keeping spending growth sustainable and strategically utilizing available resources, including fair share surtax revenues, this budget ensures Massachusetts will continue to thrive in fiscal 27 despite ongoing national economic uncertainty, end quote. The announcement from Healey's office, issued just after 2 p.m., included a photo of the governor rifling through the budget, flanked in her ceremonial office by Gorskovich and Senate President Karen Spilka. The event was not on Healey's public schedule. Healey has maintained a relatively light public schedule this week, though she's met privately twice with leaders from the Massachusetts Nurses Association and Mass General Brigham surrounding the strike at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She also attended the wake and funeral of State Police Trooper Jacob Mick. In a statement, the governor said, quote, this budget is about lowering people's costs, driving economic growth, and supporting our kids, all without raising any taxes or fees. We're helping families afford child care, health care, and higher education, increasing support for our cities, towns, and schools that we know are facing financial challenges, speeding up housing production to lower costs, and making health insurance more affordable, end quote. Last year, Healey signed the budget on July 4th, the same day President Donald Trump signed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that could result in more than 300,000 Bay Staters losing their health insurance and could cost Massachusetts millions of dollars if the state's error rate for SNAP benefit remains high. Representing a 3.9% spending increase over fiscal 2026 and drawing on $2.7 billion in surtax revenues on the state's high earners, the latest budget does not raise any taxes or fees. It also steers $51 million into the state's rainy day fund, which is on track to climb to $8.2 billion by the end of fiscal 2027. Among its policy provisions, the budget revives a long-sought-after commission to evaluate K-12 education funding, boosts oversight of special education transportation spending, installs sexual exploitation protections for minors ages 16 and 17, tackles wrong-way driving with new infrastructure and officer trainings, extends the Connected Care pilot program for highly subsidized coverage, caps annual mass health dental benefits at $1,750, and launches a panel to explore service gaps for young adults with disabilities who are turning 22 and aging out of special education. Candidates for state and local office would also no longer have their home addresses printed on ballots under a Senator Becker Rausch policy that made it into the compromise budget. That was a policy rider. The Needham Democrat said some potential office seekers are deciding not to run over fears of political violence amid escalating incidents, including the assassinations of two Minnesota politicians last year. House and Senate negotiators agreed to increase unrestricted local government aid by $40 million. That brings total funding to $1.363 billion, with the new money to be distributed on a per capita basis under the Senate-initiated proposal. Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation President Doug Howgate said the budget accord was, quote, remarkably aligned, end quote, with Healey's January proposal and closes a $3.5 billion gap between projected revenues and spending. Despite concerns about the federal funding outlook, the budget relies on more federal revenues compared to fiscal 2026, Howgate said. The compromise budget allocates $122 million for caseworkers at the Department of Transitional Assistance, which the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center said would be a nearly $21 million drop compared to expected funding in fiscal 2026. The funding level would translate into 150 caseworkers being laid off, Mass Budget said, while citing an analysis from the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Up next, a staff report from July 10th. Out of New Salem, a 26-year-old Athol man was killed in a single-vehicle crash that occurred at approximately 5 a.m. Friday. Melissa Sipple, spokesperson for the Northwestern District Attorney's Office, said in a statement that first responders were called to the area of 100 Blackington Road after receiving reports of a crash. According to the statement, quote, a preliminary investigation indicates a Dodge truck was traveling southbound on Blackington Road when it crossed the roadway into the northbound lane, exited the roadway, and struck a telephone pole. It does not appear any other vehicles were involved in the crash, end quote. According to Sipple, the driver, a 26-year-old man from Athol, was the vehicle's sole occupant and was pronounced dead at the scene. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner will determine the exact cause of death. The crash remains under investigation by the DA's office, the Massachusetts State Police Collision Analysis and Reconstruction Section, the Massachusetts State Police Crime Scene Services Section, and the Orange Police Department. Up next, Senate skips social media ban, targets addictive design instead. This is by Katie Castellani in a July 9th story. Castellani writes, Senators last Thursday unveiled a proposal aimed at limiting youth exposure to addictive aspects of social media, one that differs dramatically from a social media ban the House has already passed. The bill, Senate 3164, slated for a debate this week, would require all social media platforms to adopt default settings for minors or others who choose to opt into the settings that limit things like algorithmic feeds, autoplay, and infinite scroll. The bill also requires platforms to send users a reminder once they've been using the app for one cumulative hour within a 24-hour period. After that, platforms must send additional reminders every 30 minutes. Also, the bill would mandate notifications be turned off between 12 a.m. and 6 a.m. Minors under 18 would not be able to change the settings, and the bill leans on the Attorney General to identify age verification methods. During a briefing with reporters, Senator Julian Scheer recalled that the social media, when he was in high school and college, quote, wasn't an endless loop of algorithmic doom, scrolling, and a misinformation trap, end quote. He added, quote, and in many respects, the provisions in the Senate bill aim to go back to the OG social media for young people when it was actually a network, not an addictive rabbit hole of curated content, end quote. The bill is a Ways and Means redraft of legislation that Senator Cindy Cream sponsored. Members of the Senate Ways and Means Committee voted 14-0 to report out the new draft, with Republican Senators Kelly Dooner and Ryan Fatman opting out of voting yes or no, and Democratic Senators Paul Mark and Liz Miranda not responding to the poll. Senators are scheduled to debate the bill Thursday, July 9th. Unlike the House's social media legislation, which was embedded in House Bill 5366 that also banned student cell phone use in school, the Senate's proposal does not prohibit kids or teens under a certain age from accessing social media platforms. The version that passed the House in April bans children under 14 from using social media platforms and requires platforms to get parental consent for users aged 14 and 15. Digital and LGBTQ plus advocacy groups have criticized the House social media policies over concerns about how it addresses data privacy and affects LGBTQ plus youth. The industry has also challenged social media verification laws, with some arguing the policies violate First Amendment rights. Sarah noted that addressing social media harms is, quote, one of the most difficult policy changes we've had to navigate, end quote. That's because there's evidence that social media and its addicting features is contributing to a youth mental health crisis. But also, many young people, especially LGBTQ plus youth and other vulnerable groups, rely on the internet to find support, friendship, or resources. He said, quote, so if we get this policy wrong, we risk cutting off exactly the young people who most need those connections. So that's why this legislation walks a careful line, end quote. Sear added, quote, we're protecting young people from manipulative platform design, not preventing them from finding community, and I think that's the balance we should be striving for on this difficult and complicated issue, end quote. Cream also said the bill was carefully crafted so it doesn't infringe on users' First Amendment rights or limit youth's ability to find community online. Cream said the only age verification the bill requires would be to ensure a user is 18 or older for enabling addictive social media features. Also, users must be able to verify their age in ways that, quote, either does not rely solely on a government-issued ID or that otherwise allows them to remain anonymous on the platform, end quote, according to a bill fact sheet provided by the Senate. Asked by a reporter about the choice to leave government-issued IDs out of the age verification process, Cream noted the bill leaves the daunting task of promulgating age verification methods with the Attorney General's office. She said, quote, we wanted to balance the need to determine the age with issues like data privacy. We want to make sure, like in this bill, whatever they use to identify their age cannot be kept by the company or used for any other purpose, end quote. The bill also includes data privacy provisions by requiring apps to create other default settings that disable the visibility and sharing of a minor's precise geolocation data, limit minors' direct messaging and content sharing to their connected accounts, as well as limiting the visibility of posts and other content on minors' pages to their connected accounts. The default setting for a minor's geolocation data could only be turned off by the minor with their parent or guardian's consent. Minors could also change the settings for sending or receiving messages and content, a move that, quote, acknowledges that social media in smaller doses can have benefits for isolated or disconnected kids, including LGBTQ plus youth who may not live in affirming households or communities, end quote, the Senate's fact sheet said. Governor Maura Healey's social media policies that she proposed in a supplemental spending bill also would require social media platforms to have a default setting that disables addictive practices. The governor's social media proposal, which the House cut out of the version of the spending bill passed in June, also sets a two-hour time limit for users under 18. Asked why the Senate did not adopt the governor's proposed time limit, Cream said, quote, we went in a direction that we thought really had stood up to constitutional muster, end quote. While the Senate's proposal includes far fewer restrictions on youth social media use than the governor's or House's proposals, Sears said it's important to teach kids and teens how to use the technology. Cream noted that the fiscal 2027 budget lawmakers laid on Healey's desk Wednesday includes funding for curriculum focused on social media harms. The budget includes $2 billion for the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, or DESE, quote, to give grants to school districts to support the education of students on safe, responsible, and healthy social media use, end quote. This includes, quote, curriculum frameworks and other instructional materials to promote evidence-based practices, end quote, according to the budget's language. The Senate social media proposal could create a complicated dynamic for a six-person conference committee that already has the House's social media policy on the table, along with the cell phone ban measures. Asked about how lawmakers are planning to handle a bill's future, Cream said, quote, that's a great question. I think we're all curious. I think we need to work out the procedural question with our counterparts, end quote. And she said, quote, I have every hope that we will work out a way that we can both take it. I don't think we've had an opportunity to really talk with the House about that because we haven't passed it, end quote. Here's a quick look ahead at the weather for the Athol area. Monday the 13th, partly cloudy skies, a high of 85 and a low of 63. Now we're going to reach into the 90s. On Tuesday the 14th, partly cloudy skies, mid-90s at 95 is a high with a low of 73. And on Wednesday the 15th, a high of 91, a low of 64, and partly cloudy skies. The skies remain partly cloudy on Thursday, but the temperatures dip down into the 80s with a high of 87 and a low of 59. We then go to Friday the 17th with a high of 84, a low of 57, and mostly sunny skies. And Saturday the 18th, evening or afternoon showers possible with a high of 80 and a low of 61. And on Sunday the 19th, a high of 82, a low of 60, with evening or afternoon thunderstorms. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal. a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Walter Bird. Thank you for listening.